I could buy into that 100%.
Lizzie will get sold into the cult. Sorry.
Bye, Lizzie. Write me some letters.
Bye, Lizzie. She's like, community.
That's how they get me, you know?
That's how they get you. Hi, welcome to season 13 of She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time.
This season's theme is all things residential. We are talking about ladies who were involved in residential projects.
As always, we're not experts. We're just sharing stories about the information that we find. As friends, having a fun conversation. If you find an error, send us an email and we will all continue learning.
This week, we will be discussing Alice Constance Austin, a self-taught designer who was also a feminist and a socialist. I'm Jessica Rogers, currently eating Memphis barbecue in Memphis, but I recorded this episode in Miami, Florida.
Mm. Hey there, I'm Lizzie Rahr, craving bread belly pastries in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I'm Nurjiri Rivas, dreaming of mofongo in Houston, Texas.
Mm. Y'all, if we didn't have a history podcast, we should have an eating podcast.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh.
All right, so let's begin on March 24th, 1862. Alice Constance Austin was born in Chicago. She would be the only daughter of Joseph Burns Austin, a railroad and mining executive, and her mother, Sarah Leavitt Austin. She had two brothers, and the only other thing to note about her family was that she had a cousin who was a famous painter named Cecilia Beaux.
Ooh, that's interesting. What a pretty name.
Related to a famous artist. This is starting off well.
Yeah. So for Alice's childhood, I have no idea. Not much can be found. But we can assume that given that her father's position as an executive in railroads and mining, that they would be fairly well off. The family would travel all over the country and the world. She would travel to England, Belgium, France, Germany, and Italy.
What a great sounding childhood.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds nice.
So when you travel out of the country, right, they ask you what your profession is. Well, for Alice, she would say that she was a teacher. In some circles, she was known as a polyglot, and to others, well, they would just say that Alice had a gift for languages.
A polyglot. I mentioned at the beginning of the season of my dream of being a polyglot. I already like Alice.
Yeah. I wonder how many languages she knew.
Yeah, that I couldn't find. Maybe if she was considered to have a gift of languages, I would think that she was similar to you, Lizzie. Like, I would say that you have a gift of languages. Like, you seem to pick them up rather quickly.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Would you agree, Najdi? I feel like she would.
I definitely agree.
Okay, so if you remember from my introduction, Alice is self-taught, right? So her school was the world. The project that was the only one that got built was a house she designed for herself and her parents in Mission Canyon, Santa Barbara in 1888.
Oh, okay. I'm very curious how she fits into this season or this show for that matter. I mean, if we're going to include people who only have one project to their name, I don't want to be too selective, but this bar feels a little low.
Wow, Nurjiri coming in.
This is my energy today.
That's the energy she's bringing.
Yeah, okay. I see where we're going.
Yeah.
I'm one to talk.
I was going to say, last week.
We spent like 20 minutes talking about an artist.
Those were little breadcrumbs. You're telling me right now this information? Like, I'm curious.
I'm just keeping it real.
Okay, okay.
Well, let's hold judgment until we hear about it, you know? Like, let's see.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay, hello. By now, after 12 seasons, you know I like to bring something different. So just you wait, Najdi. I will change your mind by the end of the episode. Okay. To Alice. So there's no photos of said house. But that's not the point of the story, okay? I'm not here to talk about that project. But what caught my attention about Miss Alice was that she had all of these interesting theories and manifestos on cities and urban planning.
Mm.
But before I get into that, let's talk about her inspo.
Okay. Yes, let's.
Okay, okay. She's impacting the built environment through her theories. I am ready to be impressed.
Okay. Glad. I'm glad I'm slowly reeling you back in.
No, that was pretty quick. That was like less than 2 minutes.
Like, oh, yes. A total 180. As soon as you said urban planning, she was like, oh, hello.
Ah, true, true. I knew I wasn't going to lose you.
Never.
Jessica knows her audience.
Yes. Okay, so like I said, the world was Alice's university. Okay. One of my sources mentioned that her exposure to seeing European workers' housing and early socialist experiments would inform her interest in alternative urban models of housing.
This feels true with quite a few ladies that we've talked about.
Yeah.
Probably not her formal teachers, but teachers in her head or influencers would be people like Ebenezer Howard and Edward Bellamy, who I think we might have talked about before.
I can't remember if we've mentioned them on the show, but Ebenezer Howard was an English urban planner and was the founder of the Garden City movement, which we studied in college. So that might be why the name sounds familiar. So the Garden Cities had a central city and then like satellite communities in concentric circles around the center, and they were separated by green belts. The idea is that we shouldn't be separated from nature, and the various satellite areas would be grouped into categories of industry, agriculture at the outermost rings, and then residential areas within that. Part of this idea was to gain the benefits of both city and rural areas, but avoid the downsides of each of them. So two of these cities were built in the UK, and then they sparked other versions around the world, including a few in the US.
At first, I didn't recognize either of those names, but then the more I thought about it, I was like, yeah, Ebenezer sounds familiar. And now that you mention it, he definitely does. I remember him in college and also for the AREs. Like, he showed up in my study material.
Yeah.
About the Garden City movement.
Garden City. Yeah.
Okay, that's where the name came up.
Yeah. So I decided to look up Edward. He was a journalist and a political activist who wrote a utopian novel called Looking Backward, which advocated for the state owning the main pillars of the economy, nationalizing important resources. If you think that smells like socialism, it does. You know that. I know that. Most importantly, Edward knew that. He knew the American public would be like, P.U. socialism. So he called it nationalism. And to that, people were like, oh, yeah. And they started nationalist clubs. And it was a big thing in the late 1800s. Looking Backwards became the third best-selling novel of the 19th century in the U.S.
Oh, wow. Way to PR that into popularity, though.
Yeah, I liked it.
Let me rebrand.
Yeah. Okay. So talking about these guys, like Lizzie said, you mentioned the Garden City movement, which leads me to one of the plans that Alice is probably most known for, her plan for the ideal socialist city.
Oh, is there such a thing? Color me curious.
Apparently. I mean, I'm intrigued to hear what the Garden City plus the ideas of Edward mixed together to become. Apparently there is such a thing, Nurjiti. She designed it. So.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Woo!
Here we go. Okay. Woo. So around 1915, Alice would become buddy-buddy with a man named Job Harriman. He was a lawyer in L.A. and a prominent figure of the Socialist Party. He actually ran with Eugene Debs for president in 1900 and almost became mayor of L.A. in 1911.
Oh, this is all pre-World War I. As the story has developed, I've been wondering if socialism was more accepted in the U.S. at the time. From the little bit that I looked up on Edward, my guess would be no, but actually maybe still more accepted at that time than it is today. I can see myself losing 3 hours of my life looking up the politics of the early 1900s, so I'm going to stop right now. What are Alice and Job gonna cook up?
A waterfall to chase another time. But I do think that pre-World War II and the Cold War, it wasn't popular per se, but maybe wasn't as villainized. Like, that's my sense based on, like, things that I've read or seen. Who knows?
Yeah. So to both of your points, I don't think it was vilified,
right,
villainized, but it was definitely a growing group. enough for the guy to think that he could run for governor.
Right.
But still not popular enough that said candidate could win. So when Job lost all of those times, he still had this idea of creating a cooperative colony in the Antelope Valley north of Los Angeles, or an area called Llano del Rio. The idea was that this area would become this grand socialist city.
Wow, I'm finding this leap kind of hilarious. The voters say no multiple times, and he hears, oh, let me start a colony. I guess that makes sense.
Well, I guess he decided he wanted to live around people who agree with him. Or maybe he thought he could convince them of his ideas if they saw it in practice and experienced it. So is Alice part of the master planning, or was she going and she bought into this and built a house there?
Ding, ding, ding. She was part of the master planning.
Okay.
Alice would describe this colony as, quote, beautiful, of course. It should be constructed on a definite plan, thus illustrating in a concrete way the solidarity of the community. It should emphasize the fundamental principle of equal opportunity for all, and it should be the last word in the application of scientific discovery to everyday life, putting every labor-saving device at the service of every citizen.
This sounds too good to be true.
So the town was designed to house about 10,000 people, all within a 1 square mile area. The layout was circular, not just for visual appeal, but to promote equal access and make infrastructure more efficient. Instead of each home handling everything on its own, Alice's plan shifted much of the daily domestic life to shared facilities, central kitchens, laundries, childcare centers, and a network of underground tunnels would handle everything from food delivery to utilities. The idea was to streamline how the city worked, so residents could focus less on chores and more on community life.
Seriously, that sounds beautiful, but kind of, sort of, not really. Number one, Jessica, did they lose you at shared central kitchens? Humans are territorial. We want our own dishwashers loaded our own way.
Amen.
Number two, while the overwhelming majority of people are great, thank goodness, we still got slackers, we got thieves, we got people that will take advantage of the system and not pull their weight. Mm-hmm. I can see this working with a small group of friends that love each other like we do. But among 10,000 strangers, unless you're starting a cult that in a few years becomes a Netflix special, I don't think so. Number three, no thank you. Okay, just no.
Virginie would not be recruited to this cult. I mean, town.
She's not part of it.
Okay, I'll say from an architectural standpoint, this has some merit. I would be interested to see how programming is divided, all that goes underground, and how it could almost be like a second city underground. That sounds really cool.
Okay, I mean, I do like having my own kitchen. But the idea of streamlining day-to-day tasks or life admin so that you can focus on community more sounds really, really great. I could buy into that 100%. But, you know, essentially sharing those loads among many people so that it feels more manageable, right?
Yeah.
I guess, how does that get enforced so that it's truly shared among everyone? Or is it just shared facilities that are central to promote people meeting in those spaces and interacting with one another instead of shutting up in your house to cook and do laundry? Like, maybe it's not necessarily like, you know, it's more just like doing those tasks in a communal space to promote it, but not necessarily hoping that everyone is pulling their weight, you know?
So for the record, I'm neutral with this community idea. Like you said, Nergity, I like having my own kitchen and loading the dishwasher my own way. If you know, you know. And to your second point, it does almost sound too good to be true. If anything, it's giving post-apocalyptic District 12 Pan Am via Hunger Games vibes.
You don't sound neutral. You sound like you're on my camp.
Either way.
Don't be scared. It's okay.
The reason why I thought that this was a good story to tell in this season was purely based on the architecture of it all. Designing a house without a kitchen. Like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the ideas and the architecture are interesting, and they make for a fun debate.
So back to Alice and this town, though. So all the utilities would be underground to streamline construction to preserve the beauty and functionality of communal spaces. The houses would be equal in size because she believed in equal access to housing for her socialist way of thinking. Decoration of said houses would be a personal preference, but she offered renderings of alternative schemes. Oh, and in her master plan, she set aside land for future architects to experiment and for those who still wanted to build a conventional single-family home.
Oh, so now we're outcasting some people? No. Either you buy into the philosophy full on or you don't. Shun the non-believers.
I like the space for experimental design, but it does seem like offering single-family home options could create some animosity or chaos.
Yeah. I will say maybe because I only know the basic principles of this town, but it just sounds super idealistic. Like, to Nerjity's early point, I feel like the experimental area would be somewhere in the corner, somewhere to not disturb the aesthetic of it all. I also feel like, sure, they would allow some variation, but after a couple of years, they might be like, no, we want uniformity.
I said it before and I say it again. You say you're neutral, but you're agreeing with me more often than not.
That's why we have podcasts, to talk about our opinions. Okay, so let's get into some of the details of some of her concepts, right? Those houses were designed to be like concrete row houses with shared courtyards to promote passive climate control. The furniture was designed to be built in to minimize dust accumulation and spatial clutter. There would be radiant heated tile floors and the elimination of curtains to reduce the material and labor costs of domestic upkeep. Decorative window casings crafted in local workshops, integrating arts and crafts principles, and suggesting a locally rooted craft-based economy.
This I can get behind. The architect me is into it, but they said people can personalize their spaces, but then it turns out it has to be within their guidelines that they set. No curtains, no bringing your own furniture that has been passed through generations in your family. Again, I'm very skeptical of this. Pick a lane.
It's like an HOA, right? Like, you can do your own thing, but it has to be within the guidelines.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good, and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.
Well, my first thought was, so everyone be seeing me changing then? I clocked the curtains. That was the thing for me.
Well, I thought they had shutters. Like, instead of curtains, maybe they had, like, built-in...
But it doesn't say that.
You're right. I made that up.
Yeah, I just said curtains.
I like the idea of the built-in furniture, less upkeep with the curtains, etc., but like also privacy. I mean, I get the idea that they're trying to promote community, so they don't want people just like shutting their curtains and hermiting. I get that, but I feel like there are instances of needing a curtain for like changing or be able to sleep in for those who are light sensitive. So otherwise, I'm into the main idea of this design for the climate control, the courtyard living, etc.
Her biggest thing was, I guess, domestic upkeep.
Sure.
Like, she didn't want you to be, like, spending time steaming curtains or sweeping under and moving furniture around. The thing that caught my attention in the first place was this notion of the kitchenless house, or, like, the abolishment of the private kitchen.
Yeah.
So, without going too much further, ladies, what are your initial thoughts of the idea of just, like, I mean, we've had our ideas about the kitchenless house, but, like, let's talk about that a little bit more. But before we do, this is a good time to hear a word from our sponsors. And we're back. So before the break, I asked the ladies what their thoughts were on the concept of a kitchenless house. Nojiri.
I think it's pretty obvious that I'm skeptical about this whole thing. But as a person that does not enjoy cooking and spends very little time in the kitchen, the kitchenless house is probably the most unconventional part of this scheme that wouldn't make me bat an eye.
Well, as a person who loves cooking and baking, this would be a little bit tough for me. But I'm also very social and extroverted, so having a shared kitchen could possibly work for me. I think it's more about I like things a certain way, right? And it's hard when you cook in someone else's kitchen and you don't know it very well, but
yeah.
I guess I'd get used to it. You know, like I'll know where everything is in the communal kitchen. But what if you want a late night snack? Like you can't just have a fridge around?
Yeah, like a mini fridge.
Yeah.
Snack bar.
It's more that kind of stuff. I like the idea of the like cooking together or like cooking in a space with others. But
for me, initially, this is what caught my eye because all I've ever known, at least in today's world, is that the kitchen is the heart of the home. It's central to everything. So in a season about all things residential, what do? When you take out the heart of the home?
Yeah.
Well, I have to disagree with you there. For me, the heart of the home is the living room that has the couch in front of the TV. I don't think I'm alone in this. But anyway, okay.
Maybe today you are, but...
Yes.
Oh, in this room? Yes.
In this?
In Alice's world...
Let's say I agree with you. The kitchen is the heart of the home. Then in this socialist experiment, Alice has to take the heart out because it's about creating a heart for the community, not for the individual homes like Lizzie has been describing. She has to encourage, if not force, interaction and connection. The kitchen and the dining areas are communal. People's home are for sleeping.
Yeah. Well, the living room's the heart of the home for you because you don't like to cook.
Yeah.
But in the kitchen, you're just alone cooking. In the living room, you're sitting with people discussing things, watching TV.
In Alice's world, yes, but not in my world or in Lizzie's world.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say is that, like, I mean, we talk about this at work all the time is that people, I think that's part of the reason that, like, open concept plans have become such a big thing because, like, everyone ends up gathering in the kitchen around whoever's cooking. And at a dinner party, that's where the host is and that kind of thing. So I think that's why it's become so popular. So that it doesn't make the person who's cooking feel separated and it's more interactive and social. So, I mean, I think the living room and the kitchen, like being near one another has become, and so it's like they're kind of both the heart, but it's like, I think the idea of communal gathering around a table is very much like the heart of the home. And so the kitchen is part of that, right? And I agree with you though, Nurjadi, like your second part is like, I think, Jessica, that's why exactly she took it away, because it's forcing people to gather together around the kitchen and the dining areas and whatnot. And so I can see how she would want to take that space and make it truly communal. And it would be an adjustment, but...
Yeah. So this brings me back to Alice and her why. Like, what was her reason for taking the kitchen out of the home? Alice wanted to challenge the gendered assumptions embedded in American residential architecture. She envisioned homes and cities not around nuclear family norms or consumer status symbols, but around equity, collective care, and shared labor. Her belief that women should not be confined to unpaid domestic work was grounded in the broader movement of material feminism.
I mean, I like this part for sure. It would definitely shine a light on all the tasks that are typically relegated to women, right? If you take those and put them all into a communal space, right? And this is in what year? 1915? This would definitely have been radical for the time. So I appreciate that piece of it that she's trying to promote.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I can get behind this. I mean, overall, I like this experiment and how it materialized itself in the built environment, but I just don't see how it works for 10,000 people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw on Instagram a group that is trying to buy an apartment complex in Puerto Rico to begin a community living project. The project is called Base Comunitaria, if I'm not mistaken. I think in small pockets, that sounds doable and really great. I even started looking into how to support their cause. What I'm really skeptical about is making this work at a large scale. And I don't know, Instagram knows that I'm looking into this now, because then I also got a post like in Texas, there's a community that's been buying tiny homes, and it's a group of women, same thing. They're trying to share the tasks, really similar to what you're describing right now.
Yeah.
Oh, would you look at that? Maybe they're socialists.
I can support a small socialist gathering.
In small doses, not 10,000 people.
Anyway, even if I don't agree or see myself living there, I do like that someone is thinking radically and turning things on their heads and seeing what that looks like. I'm glad that we're discussing it. And I think that this is all really interesting and layered.
I gotcha.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree. I mean, I think there are things about this that I really love and could be great additions to society. I mean, I think the American culture is very individualist, right? And that kind of thing. And so, like, I like the communal aspect of it. And it would certainly force people to work together and or work around each other for, like, laundry, cooking, etc. And I agree, though, that it seems hard to do at that large of a scale, at least right off the bat. I feel like there would have to be smaller communities within the scale. You know what I mean? Like, if there were, like, neighborhoods within this larger group that has a shared kitchen, it creates kind of like a smaller knit community that can rely on each other and that are part of kind of the larger city, if you will. But it kind of reminds me of college dorms, like the idea of sleeping areas and then common rooms and stuff like that.
That too.
Yeah. Well, this is why I wanted to tell this story. It's totally radical. A new concept that I hadn't heard of. And this like radical idea was not only just Alice's way of thinking. Enter Melusina Faye Pierce and Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who were two reformers who argued for communal domestic services and housing reform as essential to women's liberation.
Melusina Zina Faye Pierce was a lot of things. Feminist, author, teacher, music critic, organizer, and activist. What people know her for the most today is for being one of the leaders of the 19th century cooperative housekeeping movement. Zina believed true gender equality couldn't happen without women gaining economic independence. To her, the root of women's economic and intellectual oppression was unpaid, unskilled domestic work. Her big idea? Cooperative housekeeping. Women teaming up to handle household chores and actually getting paid for it, usually by charging their husbands. She even envisioned redesigning neighborhoods and homes to make it easier for women to work together on domestic tasks. And I gotta say, after all my naysaying this whole episode, when you put it like that, I am definitely picking up what Zina is putting down.
No, Janine will be a convert by the end of this episode.
I'm telling you, she's going to be designing a town.
Okay, so Charlotte Perkins Gilman Stetson was a utopian feminist. She wrote many books and was involved with the nationalist clubs that we mentioned earlier, as well as fighting for women's suffrage. Her most relevant work of writing to this episode is called Home, It's Work and Influence. Essentially, she explores women's roles in domestic tasks and argues for more equity among domestic roles and that women shouldn't be relegated into only those spheres.
Yes. So this kind of reminds me a little bit of the discussion that we had at the beginning of our season or pre-season at the Gable Media All Access conversation about women and residential architecture with our conversation with Kate Regev a little bit. We were talking about it from the architect standpoint and like how female architects impacted the residential architecture sphere a little bit. So I feel like there's some root into what Charlotte and Zena were doing too, and Alice. Okay, with such a radical idea that Alice had, there was no way that this was ever going to be built, okay? Like 10,000 people, communal kitchens, no curtains. Like,
I wish it did.
I do too.
Yeah, I wish it did. I want to see it.
I mean, yes, I would have loved to see it. I love concrete. We talked about concrete row homes with a courtyard. Forget about it. That sounds beautiful. Impractical, but beautiful. Well, there wasn't enough capital to get a town like that built. Okay. It's also said that their land inspector had tricked them and that their proposed irrigation system had failed. Oh, and don't forget, in 1917, there was also World War I.
Yeah.
You see humans be scheming and ruining things. Why the town inspector had to play them dirty like that? Was he against women's liberation?
Probably.
Did the kitchenless house offend him?
Yeah. Mm.
Was he an Ayn Rand capitalist?
Oh.
Well, no. She was still a kid. But he's proving my point why this would never work, because people be scheming. And that makes me sad, actually. That really does. I wish it did. They needed to scale back. Maybe a smaller town could have been built.
Yeah, it's such a bummer. I would have liked to see how this would play out. But I also wonder if this is partly shot down just because of fear of different ideas. Like, I mean, it is scheming, but it's more just like fear of difference, right? But maybe you're right, Nergity. If it had started smaller, maybe it could have happened. Who knows? Because then it wouldn't have felt like such a big
undertaking.
Or like so...
like a movement.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, as like something to be so afraid of, intimidating, I guess, to like to people.
It just seemed like they were trying to accomplish too much at too large of a scale.
Yeah.
And remember, it wasn't just Alice. It was her buddy Job and a couple of people that believed in this. There was a whole movement of people behind this Llano del Rio socialist commune. Like maybe not 10,000 people, but there was people willing to move to this town. So when folks realized that this commune wasn't going to happen, they decided to move to Louisiana and Alice stayed behind in California.
Louisiana? That seems like a big pivot. Like, what was happening in Louisiana that they were like, yeah, this is where we should go because we'll be accepted with our values? Like,
yeah, I agree with Lissy. What did Louisiana offer them?
Yeah.
When things went south, they went west. Like, what? You know? Honestly, I don't doubt that there were a lot of people. I'm sure that there were even 10,000 people that believed in this and wanted to get involved. Even in today's climate, I see AOC and Bernie followers crowdfunding this. Maybe someone should bring up Alice's plans. Let's get someone to build this.
A resurgence.
Now Nergity's going to start a movement. She started skeptical and now she's
for
like,
for real.
If you build it, they will come.
She's going to have an arc venture to Louisiana to find that group.
Yeah. I just want to see how it works. I'm never going to live there.
Okay. Game maker. I mean, I guess they went south and further east. And I'm also guessing that in Louisiana, they had another population group that they're just like, okay, California ain't gonna work. Come on over. We have gumbo. I don't know. Well, throughout the whole time of her designing this utopian town, Alice was writing and speaking, talking about her ideas, okay? She wrote articles with titles like Building a Socialist City and another one that's called The Socialist City.
Ooh, I'm interested in reading that. Are these available on the internet for free? Are there links that you can share?
I will have at least one link of one of them.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm curious to read them, to peruse.
Yes. So in 1935, she wrote a book called The Next Step, How to Plan for Beauty, Comfort, and Peace, with great savings affected by the reduction of waste.
She's appealing to fiscally conservative people now. I see you, Alice.
Well, maybe she came to her senses and found her flaws with her original plan.
Maybe.
Even though the majority of her commune had moved away, Alice kept advocating for her ideals while still in Los Angeles. She still advocated for making a way to reduce or eliminate housework for every citizen. She even tried to patent some of her ideas.
Yes. Keep going, Alice.
That's cool.
Yeah. I think homegirl just didn't want to clean or cook. She was like,
I mean,
me neither. Yeah.
That's what it really what it was. So she was like, I'm going to design a whole town so we just don't have to do that. I'll do anything else. Well, in 1955, Alice would pass away. Although her plans were never actualized, her ideas would leave a lasting impression. Her city planning is said to be similar to some of the New Deal era planning initiatives from Roosevelt. Even Corbusier has considered the concept of systematizing domestic labor. Or today, the idea of creating a town that is efficient and sustainable, like the tiny homes, maybe, that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, this lady was obviously way ahead of her time. I'm glad that she put those ideas to paper, and I want to see drawings of this socialist paradise.
Same. I want to know more about how it would have played out.
Yes. Now, I do have some of her plans in her show notes, so you'll just have to check them out there.
Okay.
These kinds of conversations also remind me of earlier conversations and how things like housing can have an impact on the social interactions that we have and vice versa. As controversial or ahead of her time Alice was, I thought it'd be cool to include her point of view, even if we might not agree with it. And on a side note, as much as we love talking about cult documentaries, if you know, you know, her story reminds me of the cult that never was, architectural style.
Oh my gosh.
All right. So now we have reached the second part of our episode, the caryatid. A caryatid is a stone carving of a woman used as a column or a pillar to support the structure of a Greek-style building. In each episode, we choose a caryatid, a woman who is working today, furthering the profession through their work, and who ties into the historical woman of our episode. So without further ado, drum roll, please. Mariam Issoufou Kamara. Mariam Kamara is an architect from Niger who started her own firm, Atelier Masumi, in Niamey. She's all about designing buildings and spaces that actually make sense for the culture, history, and climate of the place, especially in parts of the world that often get overlooked. She also co-founded a Seattle-based design collective and worked on big urban projects in West Africa.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, what's cool is that she didn't even start in architecture. She studied computer science at first, then switched paths later. Her thesis on women in public space in Niger got international recognition. She even made it to the Milan Triennale.
Say what?
That's super cool. What a career shift, though. From the title, it sounds like she and Alice were both trying to promote women in different spheres.
Exactly. That's what drew me into Mariam. And what also reminded me of her in relation to Alice was that Mariam has led some really impactful projects, like rethinking how urban villages in Niamey can grow sustainably and creating a pilot housing project for middle-class families that's both affordable and energy efficient. Through Atelier Masumi, she keeps pushing for innovative housing and community spaces that use local materials and traditional techniques in fresh ways. On top of all that, she also teaches urban studies at Brown University.
What a great initiative and mission.
Yeah, definitely see the connection with Alice and how they were both working to create new innovative communities for people.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
Jealous of her students. Maybe I'll apply to Brown. I've been thinking about getting a master's.
Oh, okay.
All right, before we say goodbye, we want to say thank you to CMYK for the music, John W., our technical advisor, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Remember to check out our show notes for links to all of our resources on this episode, as well as pictures of projects we've talked about.
We hope you enjoyed learning about today's lady and Caryatid along with our banter, and that you are inspired to find out more about them and other amazing professional ladies.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you've enjoyed it, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends, your neighbors, your family, tell them all. Tell them to give us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify and write us a review. This will all help us reach a wider audience and for more people to learn about these amazing ladies with us.
Your support means everything to us. If you've enjoyed our content and want other ways to help us with our mission, you can support us by visiting our website for merchandise.
If you don't need any more swag, but you'd still like to consider supporting the research we're doing, you can donate to us on our website at shebuildspodcast.com/donate, or you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/shebuildspodcast. You can also find links to all these items on our website.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com. That's GableMedia.com.
We are excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about bosses with us. You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com, leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on X, formerly known as Twitter, at shebuildspod. Until then, see ya!
Bye!
Adios!
So, well, anyway,
that's how cults happen, right? They just be naked in front of each other.
Well, you see, I like the idea.